You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. My guest today has written about something so near and dear to my heart, the sex wars. Some might say if the sex wars never happened, my whole career wouldn't exist, because certainly this is a pivotal moment in history. It happened when I was about 10 years old. And, you know, it changed the course of so many things in sex and sexuality. So let me introduce her. Lorna Bracewell is a political theorist and an assistant professor of political science at Flagler College. In 2017, she received the American Political Science Association's Oak and Young Award in Feminist Political Theory. Her scholarship focuses on feminist theory and the history of political thought and has been published in academic journals like Signs, Journal of Women in Culture and Society, and popular forums like the Washington Post. She is the author of the book, Why We Lost the Sex Wars, Sexual Freedom in the Me Too Era. Welcome to Sex Out Loud, Lorna.
Thanks for having me.
So as I said, I'm very invested in this topic. It's one that I've studied and read about, you know, since I was a little baby undergrad. And I actually did my thesis, my undergraduate thesis on Butch Femme Identity and Practice. And so I heavily quoted from many of the people that you feature in the book, many of the scholars and thinkers, including Shri Maraga, who I actually brought to campus as a guest speaker for the gay group. It was gay then. So I got to meet her and when I was like 19 and drive her to the airport, and it was a thrill. So we're going to talk about more about her in a minute. So your book is a revisionist history about the sex wars. And I think we first need to start with, for listeners who don't know, what the sex wars were and how they've been portrayed thus far in history.
Sure. So the sex wars were a series of debates amongst feminists, but as all I also try to highlight in the book, amongst lots of other folks as well. And the debates kind of pertain to a range of issues. You already alluded to one, Butch Femme identities and practices, and you know what those meant in the context of feminism and how feminists should orient themselves toward that. But also, you know, the probably most prominent issue that was debated during this time was pornography, sex work, prostitution, as you know, critics of commercial sex called it. S&M, BDSM, right? All these sorts of things. The feminist movement, and this was in a kind of period when that initial women's liberation burst of energy that starts in the late 1960s and carries on into the 70s was sort of dissipating, and these issues really came to the forefront of the movement at that time. So it's like, you know, mostly in the 1980s and 1990s, and feminists were debating, you know, what a feminist sexual politics ought to be oriented around and how feminists ought to orient themselves toward all these issues pertaining to sex and sexuality. So that's kind of what the sex wars were. Unfortunately, the way they're remembered or not remembered is as what I call a kind of catfight, where you have, you know, pro-sex feminists who are sort of, you know, portrayed as like the fun-loving, cool girl feminists versus the kind of dowdy, school-marmish, no-fun, anti-sex feminists. And I really wrote my book to try to put the nail in the coffin of that misrepresentation of the nature and character of these debates once and for all. I just want to throw all kinds of nuance and complexity over top of that catfight narrative and make us rethink the sex wars.
Yeah, right. And so you go back and you do dig into like a lot of complexity and also kind of outright misunderstanding and misrepresentation. And you also resurrect some voices which either were excluded altogether from the history, partially excluded, or weren't considered kind of in dialogue with the sex wars, right? So there's many feminist thinkers at the time, and they're kind of not considered prominent people in the sex wars, even though they too are talking and debating about sex and sexuality. But in some ways, the thing gets set up as kind of like McKinnon and Dworkin, the anti-porn feminists, against Carol Vance, Patrick Kallifia, Amber Hollabaugh. These are some names of white feminists that get sort of the spotlight. Gail Rubin. And so you first dig into the anti-pornography kind of feminist movement. Now, this was known by other names too, like pro-censorship feminists, anti-sex feminists. And many people are aware of Andrea Dworkin, Catherine McKinnon, and their sort of indelible marks left on sex and sexuality that we still talk about today. But I wonder if you might sort of briefly summarize what was going on for anti-porn feminists, what their central argument was, and then where they began to align with liberals.
Yeah. So one of the things I try to do in the book is historicize all this and put feminists like Andrea Dworkin or Catherine McKinnon kind of in their context and represent for readers a more accurate sense of the argument that they thought they were having or that they intended to have. And so one of the points that I make is that to understand anti-pornography feminism and what those feminist critics of pornography were really about, you need to understand the kind of political discourse surrounding pornography that they were responding to and contesting. And it was not a kind of pro-sex or sex-positive or pro-pornography feminist position. It was, in fact, this much older kind of classical liberal analysis of pornography. So the kind of civil libertarian position on pornography, which was by no means pro-pornography. It was more ambivalent about pornography. It was willing to tolerate pornography for the sake of, you know, liberal values like freedom of expression and personal privacy and individual liberty, right? So, So I try to show that what anti-pornography feminists were initially doing, what they set out to do with their feminist critique of pornography, was offer a feminist counterpoint to this civil libertarian, post-war liberal framing of pornography as private, apolitical, harmless speech, right? Anti-pornography feminists were trying to make the point that pornography is deeply political. They thought the politics of pornography were deeply misogynist and reactionary and harmful to women. But I think the first point they were making is that it's political. We need to understand pornography as a public political thing in which, you know, we kind of have a public interest in, you know, acting with regard to, right? So that's what I try to show is like how anti-pornography feminism starts out as this critical engagement with this very specific liberal discourse about pornography. Later, this is moving forward into like the 80s when the Dworkin-McKinnon Ordinance is kind of
on the table and being debated.
And the ordinance is to, it's for civil liability. It's not a criminal, it's not a crime, but what they want to say is that people who feel that they've been directly harmed by pornography can sue the producers and the people involved.
Yeah, like for sex discrimination, basically.
And also, just by the way, everyone who makes or watches pornography is harmed in their thinking, right?
Well, I mean, they're
in their thinking, all pornography is bad and it is about the oppression and domination of women. So
yes,
that part is pretty black and white.
Yeah, but what exactly would qualify as civilly actionable material under the ordinance is, you know, a matter of debate and dispute to this day,
right?
Legal scholars are still kind of arguing about this. Yeah. So anyway, that was their goal was to sort of like make pornography actionable as sex discrimination, which is what McKinnon had done for the concept of sexual harassment in the workplace, to make that kind of harassing behavior in the workplace civilly actionable as sex discrimination. McKinnon and Dworkin were trying to do a similar thing with respect to pornography. So anyway, this was happening. And most civil libertarian, non-feminist liberals were deeply opposed to this effort. They saw this ordinance as a threat to the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression. They thought it would have a chilling effect, you know, on all sorts of valuable speech and valuable expression. They weren't really there to defend the porn, but they had this kind of concern about a slippery slope that would lead ultimately to the curtailment and the censorship of other more valuable speech. So anyway, there was this real enmity and hostility between liberals and anti-pornography feminists. But what's interesting is after the ordinance becomes, you know, a dead letter, the Hudnut ruling, a judge, you know, finds a version of this ordinance that had been passed in the city of Indianapolis to be unconstitutional on kind of conventional liberal First Amendment grounds. Once it's no longer a viable legal possibility, you get a lot of like really prominent liberal legal theorists like Cass Sunstein, like Martha Nussbaum, like Elena Kagan, now, you know, Supreme Court Justice. They start to kind of rethink what the liberal analysis of this feminist anti-pornography shtick should be. And they actually start to like take on board aspects of it. So you get this interesting appropriation of certain anti-pornography feminist critiques of pornography by the very liberals who anti-pornography feminists set out to contest and challenge. So that's an important part of the history of the sex wars that I want to bring to the fore in the book, is I want to kind of excavate this interesting, complex relationship that a lot of these feminist positions that start the sex wars as overtly anti-liberal, illiberal, we might even say, they sort of end the sex wars in a much more ambiguous relationship to liberalism.
Or so, even in bed with liberalism. As it were. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, and so there's a really, I mean, it's a really compelling story about the sex. Okay, so on the other side of it, you're calling them sex radical feminists.
Yeah, they've that's also, my preferred name.
Yeah, they've also been known as sex positive. They've been known as pro-porn, pro-SM, anti-censorship feminists. There's like, they go by many names. So
you're and you know, libertarian feminists.
Right. So we're going to go by sex radical feminists. And it's interesting because they begin their arguments in a really radical place. Right.
Yeah.
Their vision for the future is a pretty radical, to the point where it's not just like we have the freedom to have all these different kinds of sex that fall outside the bounds of heteronormativity and specifically vanilla heteronormativity, but it's not just about the right to do SM, power play, power exchange. It's also, in terms of patrocalyphia, about the right to have public sex, about the right to have intergenerational sex with minors, which certainly was a practice in the gay male community. That's how many young gay men came out. They started relationships with older gay men. And so So in that vision, it's sort of like we cannot put limits on sexual freedom and sexual expression. And that also takes a turn at some point. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, well, can I jump in first and sort of, you mentioned there at the end that the sex radical feminist position was like, we can't put limits on our freedom to have the sex we want to have. And I mean, there's definitely something to that, right? There is a kind of libertarian streak to the sex radical feminist stuff, but it's more than that. It's not just a negative liberty to do as we wish sexually without restriction. I argue in the book that what the sex radical feminists were after was maybe what we might think of as more of a positive liberty to have the sex that we want. So not only that restraints would be removed to free us to do as we will, but that like social supports would be instituted to enable us to realize our sexual desires, right? So sexual freedom for the sex radicals was necessarily social, political, communal. It's not something it's not like something Robinson Crusoe could have on his island alone, right? And I really think that that's why I get so frustrated with people who, including, you know, some of the anti-pornography feminist critics of sex radical feminism, they want to call it, oh, it's sexual liberalism or it's sexual libertarianism. And even some of the sex radicals or people who ran in those circles want to call themselves that. And I just think that really fails to capture what to me is a really essential part of the politics of what they were trying to do, was kind of build sexual community. So that's like just, you know, one thing I wanted to jump in there. But now I've forgotten what your question even was.
Oh, that at some point this radical agenda sort of moves quietly towards something a little different.
Yeah. So they start out in this, you know, very, I don't know quite how to call it. Radical is the word that I keep, you know, coming back to, position. But once the Dworkin-McKinnon Ordinance is on the table, sex radical feminists oppose what Dworkin and McKinnon are trying to do for their own reasons that are quite different from the civil libertarian, you know, personal privacy, censorship crowd. For the sex radicals, they view pornography as a potentially liberating avenue of kind of not only personal sexual expression, but, you know, it's part of building those erotic communities that I think they're really out trying to build. And they worry that the ordinance will have this chilling effect on the production of sexual materials and the dissemination of kind of sexual knowledge and experience and fantasy that will disable their erotic community building work. So anyway, they get together to try to oppose this. But what they do, right, is they sort of strategically adopt the civil libertarian rhetoric and legal argumentation because it's like persuasive, right, to mm-hmm. judges.
Right, and because people in general, I would say not just to judges, but also people, it's like people are like, oh, I don't want censorship. Oh, now we're talking about censorship?
Right.
Yeah no, like, I can't, I'm behind you now. Forget about the SM and the porn and blah, blah, blah. But you're saying censorship. I don't want censorship. Americans don't want censorship.
Yeah.
And so then it's easier for a lot of people to get behind it.
No, that's absolutely right. Right. You mentioned, you know, that part of what the sex radical feminists were doing in the 80s was kind of defending, in a way, intergenerational sex, right? If you lead with that, you're not going to win in the court of public opinion.
Right. This is like the NAMBLA problem, right? Which is an organization that celebrates man-boy love, intergenerational sex. And people call them pedophiles, and the gay community has distanced itself dramatically, even though they have often practiced intergenerational sex. They've sort of swept that under the rug and said, no, those people are perverts and deviants.
Right.
So yeah, if you lead with like the whips and the chains, people are a little bit like, I don't know. But if you lead with free speech, people are like, yes, free speech is the most American thing ever.
Right. So these sex radicals, like Carol Vance, they form this organization called the Feminist Anti-Censorship Task Force. And their whole purpose is to oppose the Dworkin-McKinnon Ordinance wherever it is considered. And it's being, you know, considered in cities all across the United States at this point. And probably the most significant thing that FACT, Feminist Anti-Censorship Task Force, does is they write a legal brief. This is by Nan Hunter and Sylvia Law. And this FACT brief is sort of a mashup, I argue, in the book of these older sex radical arguments with sort of more conventional liberal, civil libertarian, anti-censorship arguments kind of laminated on the top. And so anyway, they file this brief, and it actually gets cited by the judge at the Hudnut ruling, finding the Dworkin-McKinnon Ordinance unconstitutional on First Amendment grounds. The judge sort of, you know, kind of famously says, even feminists oppose this, right? So anyway, what I argue in the book is that as a result of the sex radicals' sort of strategic appropriation of liberal and civil libertarian rhetoric, some of them did it knowingly and with a wink, but others, you know, and I'm thinking of people like Nadine Strossen, you know, former president of the ACLU, there's no like wink to them. This to them is anti-censorship feminism. This is sex positive feminism. They sort of weren't at the sex radical, you know, meetings, but they very much respond to these more liberal feminist anti-censorship arguments. So anyway, I argue that what happens is this kind of more radical analysis of the politics of sexuality gets sort of lost. And what we end up with at the end of the sex wars is this kind of, you know, tepid, pro-sex, very individualistic, deeply liberal feminism. And unfortunately, some of that more radical history is lost and buried. So again, I write the book to sort of bring that back to the surface and remind people that there was this really radical feminist sexual politics. It's not just individualism and privacy and expressive freedom, right? Feminism has historically been about much more than that, a much more robust vision of sexual freedom.
Okay, we're going to take our first commercial break because here we are, wrapped in capitalism and consumerism. But I want to say I appreciate my sponsors. I have sponsors that have been supporting me for years and years and support these kinds of dialogues, which, by the way, like, you know, Nike's not stepping up to do that. So I appreciate that some of these people have a politics that says, you know, you guys can have these conversations and we're not going to sort of turn our backs on you. We're actually going to give you money in order to support the show to have the conversations. So let's take a break, hear from my sponsors, and more with Lorna Bracewell when we get back. Hey, let's have a mental health check-in, why don't we? How are you feeling today? A little anxious? Have you been sleeping well? Are you lacking focus? It's okay to need help sometimes. And there are things out there that can really make a difference. Self-care, loving support, therapy, mindfulness. And now, more than ever, there are tools at your fingertips. Sex Out Loud has partnered with Calm, the number one mental wellness app, to give you the tools that improve the way you feel. Clear your head with guided daily meditations, improve your focus with Calm's curated music tracks, and drift off to dreamland with Calm's imaginative sleep stories. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. Go to calm.com/Tristan for 40% off, unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/Tristan. Sleep more, stress less, live better with Calm. Thank God summer is finally here, but you know, there's still plenty to do indoors. Dipsy is an audio app full of short, sexy stories designed to turn you on. Each Dipsy audio story features characters that feel like real people and immersive scenarios, so you feel like you're right there. Listen to stories about unbridled lust, secret hookups, long-term love, kinky adventures. They've got it all. And they release new content every week, so there's always more to explore, no matter what you're into. And if you need to wind down, Dipsy also has wellness sessions, sensual bedtime stories, and soundscapes to help you relax before you drift off. For listeners of the show, Dipsy is offering an extended 30-day free trial where you go to dipsystories.com/Tristan. That's 30 days of full access for free when you go to dipsystories.com/Tristan. dipsystories.com/Tristan. You've got to listen. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking to Lorna Bracewell, who's a professor and scholar and author of the book, Why We Lost the Sex Wars, Sexual Freedom in the Me Too Era. So another central part of your argument here is that women of color were often, their voices were not centered in sex worker debates, or they were seen as doing something different than engaging with sexual politics. And in fact, they did intervene in the sex wars, and they did have a lot to say about it. And one of the pieces of history that I didn't know about was you document what happened the day after the Barnard Conference. The Barnard Conference is considered kind of this nascent, you know, flashpoint of the sex wars, because sex positive and sex radical feminists came together, and then anti-pornography feminists protested them and you know, distributed flyers about them. And so there's this sort of speak out, which is a popular thing in feminism, the next day, where people get to sort of speak their truth and they're not sitting on kind of panels or doing it in an academic setting. And two people in particular speak up, two women of color, Mirtha Quintanales and Sheree Moraga. And like really in direct ways say, hey, you're not listening to us. Or, hey, I want to be in this with you, but women of color are facing other issues and related issues and issues that intersect with the issues of white feminists. And if we are not part of the discussion, then this is, again, this is about white feminism, right? It's not a full inclusive feminism. And so let's talk a little bit about that, because it seems like a really crucial period. And then they also write some things after that. And Sheree Moraga writes to Off Our Backs, which is this lesbian publication, the one that On Our Backs actually named itself after as a counterpoint. Okay, so let's talk about that whole scene.
Yeah, I mean, it's really moving. And you know, I'm so happy that you learned something from my book.
Yeah, yeah.
Of all the people I would think would have absolutely nothing to learn from my book.
No. It would be me.
I've learned so much from you that it's very nice to hear that I managed to bring something new to you. But yeah, it's really moving, literally through tears, you know, at a panel at the Barnard Conference itself. But also at this post-conference speak out on politically incorrect sex, Sheree Moraga and Mirtha Quintanales, you know, attempt to intervene in the midst of sex radical feminism to make it more intersectional, right?
Intersectional was a word.
Right. Or just kind of as it was just, you know, kind of being worked out and becoming
right.
a kind of feminist concept and practice. And they're just not heard, and you know, really continued not to be heard for decades, right? And while I'm very honored that I got to be the scholar who went back into the archive to reintroduce their interventions to people who are interested, it's so depressing to think that, you know, it was me and that was work that had to be done. So anyway, yeah, so there's this kind of aspect of the catfight narrative that I mentioned earlier that my book is trying to contest. It's that very simplistic white hat, black hat kind of framing of the sex wars. One aspect of that narrative that is the most misleading is that the sex wars were a kind of purely white feminist event or debate. That, you know, while white feminists were bickering about porn, feminists of color, black and third world feminists, were kind of off doing something else. And, you know, there's a kind of women of color kind of programming of the catfight narrative, which is like they were off doing something more important, right?
Right.
Not kind of frivolous, you know, stuff mm-hmm. like these, you know, silly white feminists were doing at the time. But there's also a kind of, you know, I guess more critical kind of version of it, which is like, you know, well, where were the black feminists? Why weren't they caring about sexual oppression and sexual injustice and sexual freedom? You know, they're so conservative and so traditionalist, or there's some, you know, there's some kind of, but anyway, what I want to show in the book is that third world feminists and black feminists were there, they were intervening, right? And that in a way, our entire understanding of what is lesbian feminism and what is black feminism needs to be rethought, because like, they're the same thing. You know, a lot of the kind of foundational texts that get taught in, you know, intro to women's studies as, you know, black, canonical black feminist texts, they're written by lesbians, right? Barbara Smith, you know, This Bridge Called My Back, right? You know, edited by, you know, two queer world women of color. So anyway, I try to show that black feminists and feminists of color have been deeply interested in sexual politics for as long as feminists have been interested in sexual politics. And I try to bring these voices into the sex wars and show what their contribution was. And what I argue is that they didn't take a side, right? It wasn't this kind of simplistic, all right, white feminists have established the parameters of the debate, pro-sex, anti-sex, which side are you on, black and third world feminists? In fact, they just like actively at every step of the way refused to do that. So you have feminists like Sherry Moraga and Mirtha Quintanilles, who we talked about earlier, who kind of, you know, decided to be in coalition with sex radical feminists. They were there participating in the Barnard Conference and in the post-conference speak out. But they did so because they wanted to shift the kind of orientation of sex radical feminist politics to make it address the sexual desires, sexual oppressions experienced by women of color. You know, they wanted to take this sex radical feminist energy, which they saw value in, and they wanted to kind of make it work for themselves and their communities. So that's what they were kind of there at Barnard to do. And one of the points that they both make so poignantly in their interventions at this conference is that there's this kind of aspect of sex radical feminists. There's a kind of vanguardism, I guess you'd call it, where it's like, we are so subversive, and in order to overthrow the oppressive structures that have kind of held us back, like what we have to do is sort of like come out and declare, right? And make public our subversive sexual desires, right? And one of the things that Moraga and Quintanilles are trying to show is like the limitations of that kind of intervention. They want to argue that like, look, like we can't just embrace this, you know, identity as like sexual renegades and sexual subversives, because that will like literally cut us off from our communities of origin.
Right.
We're trying to fight to liberate too.
Right.
So I can't just, you know, like, you know, Sherry Moraga is like, you know, as a Chicano from the borderlands, like I can't just up and move to San Francisco and leave all that behind and embrace this new identity as kind of erotic rebel, right? As much as maybe I would like to do that, right? My work, my feminist work, is to fight for the liberation of the folks I'm leaving back in Texas, right? So anyway, you know, they're trying to ask for and try to articulate a sex radical feminism that will work for them. It'll work for more than just kind of these very, you know,
well, and it also centers anti-racism. Like the other thing is, yes, like there were no real, there's no real racial analysis.
No.
I mean, there was some class analysis, like Amber Hollibaugh is definitely, you know, and Dorothy Allison definitely talking about class, but there was no racial analysis in kind of either, you know, like in either camp.
Kind of a very limited one, I would
limited,
say.
And, yeah.
And I try to show the limitations of it. You know, I engage in the book with, you know, kind of close reading of Gail Rubin's oeuvre, right? Mm-hmm. Going back to, you know, some kind of embarrassing stuff she wrote when she was an undergrad, which, you know,
I hope you don't do that to me, but okay.
But no, I then, you know, try to show how that kind of blind spot, you know, with regard to racial politics and where they intersect with sexual politics kind of persists, you know, through Thinking Sex, her famous essay. And similarly with Patrick Kalifia, you know, a charge that was often brought against feminist practitioners of S&M was that this kind of idea that you could just like make, you know, race, you could just make it like another kind of toy that you play with, another identity you try on, another kink, right? There was a lot of pushback from a whole bunch of different quarters on that. And Patrick Kalifia, you know, to his credit, tried to speak to that and kind of offer a defense, but it's, I mean, people can go read it, you know, but it's, I find it as a kind of to be an inadequate defense, right? He basically says like, look, like racism is part of the system and we're, you know, these sexual renegades who are trying to, you know, subvert and overthrow the system. So.
Well, you know. Right. And so one of the sort of radical potentials of SM, which they argue and which still holds true, is that we can create these scenes and connections and community and sex where consent is central to the equation, and we can act out and really work out some of these issues around domination and submission, which, by the way, in real life is not consensual for minorities of all kinds. And we can work some of this stuff out in these spaces that are consensual, where people do actually care about our humanity and et cetera. And so that's part of the radical potential of SM. And so in some ways, and Shereem Raga is saying, yes, I'm doing the same thing. Like I'm doing the same thing in the sex that I have, but I can't leave my racial identity kind of at the door.
It's not just a role, right?
Right. It's not.
And that, which is what Patrick Kalifia says, you know, like, look, if you could just switch your keys.
Right. And you could be a top, you could be a bottom, right. And then you could be.
Race is not like that.
Well, and also in just that space as like a sort of utopian,
yeah,
as if once we get into that space, every piece of society sort of falls away. Right. And it can't. And so oppression can't inform our BDSM. Our BDSM is sort of this other sacred space where, which is sort of protected from it, which of course we know now is not possibly true. They knew then.
I found this really great essay by Tina Portillo. And, you know, it's really hard to find firsthand accounts of non-white lesbians participating in these spaces in the 80s and 90s, like, because there just weren't a lot of them, right? Mm-hmm. But Tina Portillo gives us one. This is in Leather Folk, the anthology. And, you know, she says, like, one of her great frustrations as a Black woman trying to participate in this scene is that she can't find any white people to top her.
Right. Because that would be sort of politically incorrect, right? So all the white people are like, oh, no, no, I'm not touching that with a 10-foot pole. But please, like, dominate me because that's my politics. My politics is, yes, like, let the women of color dominate us to sort of, like, work through our own white fragility slash guilt.
And her point is, like, it's my race. Like, they won't do it because of my race. Mm-hmm. Like, it just makes them uncomfortable. It, you know, challenges or, you know, chafes against their sense of what's politically correct. And, you know, but the point is that, like, she is being discriminated against on account of her race.
Right. 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 And so, can't get her desires met.
She can't escape it.
She can't get her desires met, whereas these white women, you know, presumably can.
Yeah, and she can't just switch her role, right, in the way that a white person maybe feels that they can in those spaces. So anyway, I don't even remember the point that I was making. I just sort of, like, lapsed into story time with Lorna totally there.
Well, then you bring all of this to kind of our current moment in feminism. And so one of the things that, like, constantly went through my head as I was reading the book is – you know these memes on the internet that say how it started and how it's going?
Oh, yes.
Right? Yes. And so I kept trying to conjure, like, how it started and seeing sort of Patrick Califia flogging someone in a public space where people are sort of watching. And then how it's going is a sort of straight, cis, white woman at Slut Walk with a sign that says, I can wear a skirt as short as I want. Okay, so just, like, can you see that image? Can you see that image? Right? And it's like, is that what we've fought for? Right? Is that where it was supposed to go, or it was imagined that it was gonna go? So tell me how this ties into kind of contemporary feminism.
Yeah, I love that use of that meme. I need to go make that.
Okay, go make that meme. Go make that meme. Great. Yeah.
So what I argue is that what we end the sex wars with are sort of liberal reprogrammings of these very radical positions that we started the sex wars with. So you have for lack of a better metaphor, and I'll regret this the minute that I say it, you have kind of neutered, you know, versions of...
Diluted, yeah.
Diluted, thank you for saving me there. I call, you know, the positions that are kind of left over at the end of the sex wars, anti-pornography liberalism, where you have liberals like, you know, again, Elena Kagan, Cass Sunstein, arguing for the criminal regulation of pornography, which is not something that anti-pornography feminists like McKinnon and Dworkin ever did. In fact, it's something that they vehemently opposed. One of the big reasons that they were trying to argue into existence this alternative legal framework for regulating pornography that was civil was because they thought the current existing legal framework for regulating pornography, and yes, there is one, is criminal. It's called mm-hmm. obscenity law. Mm-hmm. And they thought it was deeply patriarchal and bad, you know, for women and unjust, and they wanted to destroy it, right? Which is, that's not, you know, when we talk about the anti-censorship feminism, right, we don't often, you know, remember that, you know, one of their missions was to destroy the existing regime of obscenity regulation. So anyway, you know, but liberals who kind of take on board certain aspects of the anti-pornography feminist critique of pornography, they want the criminal regulation of pornography. So, you know, one example of this is in this ACLU report, of all things, called Polluting the Censorship Debate. I don't have the year of publication on the tip of my tongue here, but it's in the late 80s. And what you see is they're arguing in favor of a pretty draconian regime of child pornography laws that, of course, now we have, but the ACLU supported it, right? And, you know, that you know, we end up in that position where you have a civil libertarian group arguing in favor of a pretty expansive draconian regime of pornography regulation because of the advent of this anti-pornography liberalism. And then, you know, if you look over on the kind of sex radical side, anti-censorship feminists are willing to support, again, an awful lot of kind of criminal regulation of a whole bunch of sexual activity, right? That sex radical feminists would have opposed. And I talk about the slutwalk movement as kind of embodying, if you will, the liberalization of these two feminist positions. A lot of scholars have looked at slutwalk and rightfully seen an interesting amalgam of anti-pornography feminism with its concern about sexual violence, rape, and sex radical feminism with its emphasis on, you know, kind of robust public sexual culture and freedom of sexual expression, right? The valorization of the identity of slut, right? And there's definitely something to that. But, you know, what I think is the most significant aspect of the slutwalk movement is the extent to which it views criminal law, criminal justice, police, you know, and prosecution and arrests and, you know, prisons as the antidote to rape culture, right? So in the original slutwalk march in Toronto, you actually have, you know, it starts because a cop comes to some like campus, you know, event to talk about, you know, rape and advises the students to not dress like sluts so they don't get raped. So that's what kind of prompts the outrage and the organizers of slutwalk to organize the first slutwalk march. But what do? Well, they march to the headquarters of the Toronto police dressed as sluts, you know, fishnets and whatnot. And they basically, you know, prostrate themselves there and say, protect us, right? We are as deserving, we sluts are as deserving of your benevolent protection as any other citizen. So there, I think you get this really problematic framing of criminal justice as the antidote to rape culture. It's a really vivid example, I argue, of carceral feminism. And I think the only way that you're able to end up in that space in the 21st century is because of these shifts and turns in the relationship of liberalism and feminism during the sex wars that I document in the book.
Yeah. So one of the things that I thought of that immediately came to mind when you were talking about, especially about the free speech issue, is that the sort of professional slash lobbying organization of the porn industry is called the Free Speech Coalition.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Which seems Smart. Like a complete Smart. Like illustration of your point. Yeah. And on their website, it says it opposes the passage and enforcement of obscenity laws and many censorship laws. Meaning, again, like we still think certain things should be censored according to maybe like our moral compass, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, so this is like a coalition of people who don't want obscenity laws and don't want some censorship laws. When in fact, like, it could be a coalition of folks who do things that like fly in the face of all that is proper and moral and decent and good as conceptualized by sort of American citizenship. You know, this could be a coalition, especially of women who use their bodies in a way that they aren't supposed to. This could be a coalition of people. I mean, it is a coalition of people who do double anal and gangbangs, right?
Right.
And it is wrapped in capitalism. I want to acknowledge that. But there's also radical community within the sex worker communities, and in a way that Patrick Califia maybe envisioned all the way back then, right? Because there is a sense of like mutual aid and building a kind of renegade culture that is clearly outside of mainstream culture. But instead of saying that, instead of sort of branding themselves as that, they're branding themselves as Free Speech Coalition, which does feel diluted and doesn't feel like it reflects some of the radicalism of porn performers.
Yeah, and it allows for, you know, dynamics of, you know, scapegoating and all sorts of things that I don't have to tell you about, right? There's a lot of people who are probably technically a member of those communities and a part of that constituency who are not helped by that framing,
right?
Who are in fact just always ready to be sort of shunted aside and, you know, cast as beyond the pale and indefensible and sacrificable.
And again, the intense racism that we see in the porn industry, which has been addressed again since the 80s, but has really heated up with the form of like a BIPOC coalition within the porn industry. But this reminds me of, I was at a conference called Sex Down South. It was one of, I think it was like the first one that they had in Atlanta. And it's run by and centers women of color. So I went to this workshop with about 40 people, and I was the only white person. Not because it was a woman of color space, but because I was the only white person. But first of all, they were the majority at the conference. And so it's not that strange. But we got into a discussion, and Slut Walk came to mind. And so I asked the question to the room, how many of you like the word slut, have reclaimed the word slut, identify with the word slut? And no one raised their hand. And I thought, oh, this is a problem.
Yeah, there's a real limitation
this,
there.
Wow, yeah. This is a problem. If Slut Walk is a thing that we're all going to sort of get behind, when that actually doesn't speak at all to women of color. And women of color are like, me going out dressed as a quote slut and marching in the streets is not going to fix racism. You know, because again, sluts are punished in various ways in our culture, but sluts of color are, first of all, women of color are assumed to be sluts, right? There's still that sort of fetishization. And
they don't have to put the fishnets on.
They don't have to put the fishnets on, right? They just show up at the party in flip-flops and it's like, oh, she's hypersexual, right? So in some ways, they're sort of slutified no matter what they do. And of course, they're punished in very different ways. Sex workers of color are punished in much more frequently and more harshly than sex workers who are white. It seems like this illustration of we still have this leftover thing where white feminism isn't listening to what the central concerns are of women of color. And it's not that women of color don't want to talk about sexual politics, right? This is the whole conference is about that, right? These conversations are happening and people are thinking and people are writing books about it. But it hasn't been centered. And so the idea of dismantling the carceral state, dismantling the police, abolishing the police, and dismantling oppression as we do this work on sort of liberating sexuality, which is part of the process, hasn't been fully integrated into what I would call the sex positive movement right now.
Yeah. No, and one of the reasons I wrote the book was to in a certain way, I think that feminists were on a better footing to start grappling with this in the 1980s, you know. And you know, we've forgotten There are these resources just laying back there in the feminist past that we can go and we can pick up, right? We don't have to invent this sexual politics that we're longing for anew from whole cloth, although of course we're welcome to, right? But there are resources back there, and I think that we need to revisit the sex wars and we need to move beyond the catfight narrative to fuel the sort of anti-carceral sexual politics that I'm hearing you and it sounds like the people who organized this conference calling for as well. And I think a really crucial part of this is that we need to like acknowledge the kind of liberalism that is operating at this kind of deep conceptual level in a lot of our thinking about sexual freedom and sexual liberation. And we have to like repudiate it. Because I argue in the book and, you know, from like a pointy-headed academic perspective, this is, you know, I think an important contribution to the book. There's a lot of talk about carceral feminism and what it is and how to conceptualize it and what drives it, what fuels it. And oftentimes people will say kind of origin of carceral feminism is in this problematic alliance between feminists and conservatives, right? Which that's a legit thing. I mean, you see, you know, kind of anti-trafficking stuff, right?
Great example, right? All of that anti-trafficking stuff has to do with like a strong bond between conservatives and anti-sex worker feminists and the police, right? Which they see as the ultimate intervener.
Right. So yeah, the rescuers, right? So I don't want to like say that that's not happening. Like, but I think another thing that's fueling the carceral turn in feminism is liberalism. And in a way that's kind of paradoxical because people think of liberalism and they think of individual liberty and they think of kind of anti-statism and stuff like that. But I argue in the book that once you're kind of thinking and operating politically within this liberal conceptual domain, you know, where you're committed to things like limited government and you're kind of hemmed in by concerns about individual rights and due process and expressive freedom, it becomes really difficult to do anything about sexual violence, sexual injustice, sexual oppression, because from a liberal perspective, all that happens in the private sphere. And the private sphere is sort of definitionally sacrosanct. The state can't go there, mm-hmm. right? The state can't reach into there. If it does, it has violated your rights.
Unless it has to do with women's bodies and reproduction, but non-binary people. But okay, yeah, can't go there, right?
That's the idea, right? Unless the one exception is if it's the behavior is criminal, if it's harmful, right? And so the liberal state can act as a kind of referee. And when somebody trespasses on the rights of others, the liberal state can jump in and punish them, mm-hmm. right? Well, so that becomes, right, if you're a feminist who's concerned about sexual injustice and concerned about sexual oppression and wants sexual freedom and wants to, you know, fight rape culture and live in a world without rape, but you've signed on to this whole liberal set of commitments and concepts, literally the only tool you have is the criminal
justice system
of the state, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, your options are do nothing, right? Kind of let, you know, sexual injustice and sexual oppression just continue happening in the quote unquote private sphere and do nothing, or frame all that as a crime and therefore justify the kind of state swooping in, you know? And I just think that that's like a really unproductive place for feminism to be. And until we move beyond those artificial limitations liberalism has imposed on our thinking about sexual freedom and sexual justice, we're not going to be able to think about alternatives, right? What could I do other, you know, like the Bill Cosby thing yesterday, right, is just at the forefront of my mind.
Oh, God. Bill Cosby was released from prison and his conviction was overturned. Sigh.
Yeah. But you know, but his prosecution, his successful prosecution, was seen as a big win.
Oh yeah. No, coup. I mean, that's the thing about carceral feminism is it's like Harvey Weinstein is in jail. That's where we want him. Like
that is a
victory. Yeah, and so it's like, but these systems that allowed Harvey Weinstein to operate are still. There's a training here and there going on sensitivity, but they're still mostly intact.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we have to look for remedies to these problems beyond the criminal justice system, because first of all, those remedies are like rare, right? It's like, there's a reason it's a big deal that Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby got convicted, because it's so rare that that sort of thing happens. Right. So these tools aren't even good, right, at it.
Right.
But then there's also all these, you know, other, like, you know, obviously, like, if we put all the rapists in prison, we would still have a tremendous amount of rape, because prisons are a prime site where rape and other forms of sexual violence happen, right?
Right.
So anyway, that's kind of like, you know, my secret agenda in the book, and the reason I go through all the trouble of excavating all this history and putting it back on the table for a fresh consideration is because I really, really worry that contemporary feminism is sort of locked in this carceral feminist space and can't find a way out. So I hope in some small way my book helps some people think themselves free of some of these limiting concepts.
Well, and it's quite timely because there is now a movement and discussion around defunding the police, abolishing the police, the police as essentially ineffective for making structural change. You know, it's like the rescue, it goes back to the rescuers of the trafficked women is, I am not denying that people get into sex work by coercion, or they get into sex work and they don't want to be there. That is not their, that is not what they want to be doing. But instead of sort of critiquing capitalism and patriarchy, which fuels trafficking, especially women, non-binary people, you know, the anti-trafficking people are like, let's just get them into the system. Let's sort of try to, quote, rehabilitate them, right? Which is a very sort of victim-blaming, paternalistic idea, right? That we, and there's also this religious and morality thing that's wrapped up. Often in order to divert from being arrested for being a sex worker, even if you were trafficked or coerced into it, is if you can find God and start working a minimum wage job, then we'll help you.
Right.
Which does nothing to sort of dismantle all the things that got you there in the first place.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're out of time.
That
and
went by fast.
I also blew through my second commercial, which sometimes happens.
Oh no.
I forget. I'm looking at the clock, but I am not paying attention to it at all. So I just blew through my second commercial break. But we can work that out at the other end.
The magic. Okay.
Okay. I want to remind people, the book is called Why We Lost the Sex Wars, Sexual Freedom in the Me Too Era. It's from University of Minnesota Press, and get it where you buy books. I especially encourage you to support local and independent bookstores. You can do that online through bookshop.org. That is not a paid endorsement. That's just where I'm sending you. You can find more about the author of this book, lornabracewell.com, and on Twitter at Lorna Bracewell. Thank you so much for writing this book and for the conversations that hopefully it is going to spur.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a real honor.
I want to shout out my engineer and editor, A-Rod, at FTC Designs. You can follow him on Twitter or even hire him to do your podcast at FTC_designs. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. Thank you for your patience this past week. It was the first time in my 9-year history that I had to skip a week because of technical problems. You can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at Tristan Taramino. And in the meantime, take some time to talk about sex out loud.